Saturday is solstice, and I'll be celebrating with my favorite witch. It's 9:01 Pacific time, and I'm going to ask you to indulge me just for a moment, because I've been doing this since 1987, and it's important to me. I'm grateful to have had the opportunity to broadcast Press Watch here and on KAZI in Austin all those years ago, but now something has changed. If you search news for Press Watch on the web now, you don't so easily get my show anymore. You get a startup website, apparently, an East Coast leftish establishment-ish journalism site linked to Salon.com. They're called Press Watch, and their URL is Press Watcher. I sent them a nice letter, but I don't think it's just a mistake. That's because anyone starting off a web-linked enterprise knows to search the web first, whether it's a band name or a product or whatever. The least one can do is look first to see if someone else uses that name. It's just a practical matter. And of course, it's a matter of respect, something that one would expect from a journalist. And this new Press Watch is journalists. Here's a quote from their website. "We've also identified some solutions, such as prominently rebutting misinformation, practicing radical transparency, holding politicians accountable to the citizens' agenda, imbuing our work with civics lessons, pursuing solutions journalism, and encouraging civic engagement," end quote. Nice idea, guys. It's hard to explain why this makes me shake with rage and despair, but I'm going to give it a try. It wasn't that Press Watch that gave the Panama Deception movie the tip-off to search the Jardín de la Paz for the El Chorrillo massacre victims in 1989. It was me. They didn't expose CIA infiltration at the University of Texas in 1987. I did. It wasn't them riding a Zodiac out to the ocean-going Super Reuben in 1991, where protesters stopped old-growth logging by hanging off the sides so it wouldn't be shipped to Japan for chopsticks. It was shipped to Japan. That Press Watch was not the ones who interviewed Howard Zinn and Michio Kaku and Naomi Klein and Susan Faludi for KBOO. It was me. They didn't openly transition from male to female on KBOO airwaves in 2001. They didn't report from personal experience at the Seattle 1999 riots. They weren't the ones standing on the Burnside Bridge in 2011 counting Occupy marchers and then triumphantly describing it on air every Thursday. They weren't at the historic ICE occupation here in Portland, broadcasting from the booth Jenka and Tommy set up for KBOO. They aren't the Press Watch. I have been. They haven't put half their lives and all of their hopes and honor into that name. That name belongs to KBOO members and to me. But they took it. So thank you for your indulgence. By the way, if you want to listen to this later, the podcast is on Stitcher.com. It's on KBOO.FM/PressWatch. It's on Apple Podcasts, etc. Now for some news you're not supposed to know. Australia recorded its hottest day on record on Wednesday with an average maximum temperature of 107.4 degrees, beating the previous record by 1 degree centigrade that had been sent out only 24 hours earlier. Australia is on fire. The smoke is choking everyone in Sydney, and maybe you've seen the pictures of just how thick it is. Tuesday, the 16th of December, recorded an average of 40.9 degrees centigrade across the continent, beating the previous record of 40.3 in 2013, but it held that record for just 24 hours. Wednesday was even hotter across the country, with the highest maximum temperature reached in Birdsville, South Australia, which hit 117.8 degrees Fahrenheit. So here's the news you're not supposed to know. The climate disaster is here. It is killing now. And we have got to do something about it. Now, I could not take 117.8 degrees, period. A few days of that kind of temperature. Something you need to know is that one of the times that we had a substantial heat wave here within the last decade, the power lines sagged to the degree that power had to be cut off in several places. And if you don't have AC, then you're going to experience the full heat wave. That would kill someone like me. It is killing people around the world. The killing has started. The climate disaster is now. And something else, something that I started talking about in 94. This from EcoPlanet News. Caps of frozen CO2 or methane called hydrates, containing potent greenhouse gases, methane, keeping them from escaping into the ocean and atmosphere. They're down there at the bottom of the ocean, but the ocean's warming, and scientists say the temperature of the seawater surrounding some hydrate caps is within a few degrees of dissolving them. That would be very, very bad. Carbon dioxide is the most common greenhouse gas. The methane, the main component of natural gas, doesn't stay in the atmosphere as long, but it is 84 times more potent over two decades. This is the clathrate gun that I was talking about in 1994. The clathrate gun is getting closer, and that's just one aspect of climate change, but it is one of the most dramatic and immediate. When those clathrates burst, they will put out clouds of methane so thick that they will actually crowd out the oxygen. If you're lucky enough to be where it has dissolved some after the clathrate gun goes, then it'll be like living at 16,000 feet. A lot of you can't take that either. This is life and death, and it's now. It's happening right now. Now here's something closely related. Some are calling it a payoff. This is from TheRoot.com. Others have called it hush money and reparations. The University of North Carolina system is calling it a lawful and lasting path to prevent Confederate statues and insignia from finding homes on its campuses. But what it is, in practical terms, is a $2.5 million bonus handed directly from North Carolina's public university system into the open palms of a Confederate group, which will bear the responsibility of taking and preserving Silent Sam, the UNC Chapel Hill's controversial Confederate statue. Why is this directly related? Because this the hate statue, which was put up about a century ago in order to oppress black persons in the United States, is part of the system of apartheid, Jim Crow apartheid, enforced by our various police departments and enforced by every person unaware of or unwilling to act against their own whiteness. This means that we cannot act together, because within your Venn diagram of persons who are affected by climate change are persons who are unable to walk on the streets without fearing for their lives. This is directly related. And I'm really pleased to see Extinction Rebellion and 350.org and the other organizations calling loudly, urgently, for immediate action against the climate disaster. But you won't get my hope, and you won't get my help, until you also address and set yourselves four square against Jim Crow. Now I'd like to talk about impeachment for a moment. But first I want to talk about things that President Trump were not impeached for. He was not impeached for serial rape. He should have been. He's the pussy grabber in chief. He was not impeached for violating the sacred trust with constant lies. He was not impeached for arrogating the legislative power of the purse for his wall, thereby destroying the balance of powers and the entire constitutional framework of the United States. He is not impeached for using the prestige and power of his office for personal enrichment, the emoluments. He is not impeached for torturing and caging small children. He was not impeached for criminalizing Spanish speakers, persons of color, and transgender persons, and abandoning the public defense against corporate climate disaster. He should have been. But he was impeached on two counts. One, bribing the president of Ukraine, and two, obstructing the investigation into bribing the president of Ukraine. And that second part is just as important. And I want to point out for all of the people who've been whining that that President Trump hasn't been getting a fair deal, that impeachment is the ordinary and constitutional manner of removing a president. It's the eraser on the pencil of the Constitution. It's not extraordinary. It's not a coup. It's a legislative process, and the legislative branch is supposed to be co-equal with a president. We have three branches: the judiciary, the legislative, and the executive. And the executive is not allowed to simply arrogate the power of either of the other branches. He cannot be judge, and he cannot have the power of the purse. When the legislature decides that money is to be spent on a certain thing, that is their decision, and it is not the president's. Looking at Mike DeBonis' article in Washington Post, moments after a historic vote to impeach President Trump, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said the House could at least temporarily withhold the articles from the Senate, a decision she suggested that could depend on how the other chamber chooses to conduct its trial on Trump's removal. She's quoted saying, "We cannot name the managers until we see what the process is on the Senate side. So far, we haven't seen anything that looks fair to us. Hopefully, it will be fair, and when we see what that is, we'll send our managers," end quote. Now, I want to comment that that is a relatively weak position to what she could have done just yesterday, and which our representative, Earl Blumenauer, did suggest on the floor, that the vote itself simply be delayed until Moscow Mitch McConnell decides to have an actual trial as is demanded by the Constitution. That would mean witnesses that are actually relevant and not just bogus witnesses spewing the silly and made-up stories about Joe Biden that they wish to derail the entire public attention with. Returning to the Washington Post article, the comments came as a group of House Democrats pushed Pelosi and other leaders to withhold the articles, a notion that has gained traction among some on the political left as a way of forcing Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to conduct a trial on more favorable terms for Democrats. And if no agreement is reached, some have argued the trial could be delayed indefinitely, denying Trump an expected acquittal, end quote. Now, you'll notice that that phrasing is much more mild than what I just said. It's the Washington Post's right to make things as mild as they like, but they are one of two major, arguably three major newspapers of record in the United States, and they do this constantly. They are always leaning on the weight of the establishment and of corporate rule. But returning to that article, Pelosi would not answer questions about whether she was entertaining an indefinite hold on the articles, one that could prevent a trial from taking place before the next presidential election. She's quoted saying, "We're not having that discussion," adding that it, quote, "would have been our intention to send the articles forthwith, but we'll see what happens over there," end quote. So this will be interesting. And as I was saying, she would have more of a case if she had simply withheld the vote. That's in her lane, and I think the judiciary may pop up and say, "You are required by the Constitution to bring this to the Senate for trial." She has not said that she will not bring it to the Senate for trial, but I wonder if they will stop her delay. But the delay, I think, is at least a good idea and something that will cause more stress for the president, because it brings a longer period of time to the impeachment process. It leaves him hanging, and he can't stand it. He doesn't have the mental stability to tolerate that. Amy Goodman pointed out this morning that this hasn't been done before. This is uncharted territory, or I believe were her words. It's 9:14. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. Around the world, things are still happening, despite our dramatic impeachment processes. Rafael Casinas reports in Prensa Latina, it's been 2 months now since the outbreak of widespread protests in Chile. Effective responses to the profound changes protesters are demanding remain far off in a context of insufficient government measures and repression. The mobilizations triggered by an increase in subway fares rapidly multiplied as millions of people took to the streets to demand increases in salaries and pensions, improvements to public health and education, and a radical transformation of the prevailing neoliberal model. Now I'm going to depart from that text for a moment and comment that we need to protest here on the same reason. When they say neoliberal model in that context, they're simply referring to corporate rule, laissez-faire corporate rule, has a different meaning worldwide than it does. Liberal has a different meaning worldwide than it does here in the United States. And I just want to point out that half of us aren't making enough to live on. That's no exaggeration. Maybe you think that you just haven't been getting your stuff together well enough. Maybe you blame yourself for the fact that you run out of cash at the end of every paycheck, but half of your fellow citizens are in the same boat, and that can't be right. Please think about that for a moment. How could that possibly be right? Is this the richest nation on earth or not? This is about distribution of wealth, and more specifically, it is about maldistribution of wealth, wealth that you have created through your legitimate and very, very needed work, whether it is being a clerk at a store, whether it is raising children, important work that should be paid and paid well, whether it is teaching at a university or teaching children, you are not being paid enough. This is also true even at this educational institution. And it's this context is true because we have gotten used to it. The frog has been boiled, so to speak, if I may paraphrase Ace Hayes. Rest in peace. We've gotten used to this, but it's wrong. It's very, very, very wrong because it subjugates you. It subjugates everyone who can't even get that job. When I say half of us aren't earning enough, that's an understatement. Half of us aren't earning enough, and a large portion of us aren't earning anything and are just hanging on as best we possibly can and thinking that we're losers. That's the real crime. All the work that you've done throughout your life, and you have to fight just for a roof over your head? That is wrong. It's a violation of your human rights. Quoting an article by Mike Linden in The Guardian, for most of the last four decades, the gains from economic growth have flowed overwhelmingly to the rich. Most of those gains to the rich weren't earned in any traditional sense, but rather extracted, excess profits squeezed out of a system designed to favor those who already have power, position, and wealth. Today, top 1% of Americans own more wealth than the bottom 90% combined. It's no wonder abolishing billionaires has become a rallying cry. And speaking for myself, please do your best to extract from your mind the poisonous misinformation that billionaires earned their wealth. No one ever earned $1 billion. No one ever earned $1 billion. You earn wages. You do not earn extraction. And you can't be a billionaire without extracting at least $1,000 from a million people, or $1 million from 1,000 people, however you want to do it. But returning to the article, what does it really mean? Is setting a cap on the amount of wealth one household can own, or does it entail something a little more structural, unrigging the system that gave us billionaires and instead creating an economy in which everyday people get the benefits from the growth they've created? And this article goes on to suggest a mild tax, returning to the amount of taxes that were paid in the 40s and 50s by richest Americans. Right now, they pay about 30% of their income in taxes, the top 1%. Now, the fraction of 1%, small fraction, that are billionaires pay much smaller amounts, much smaller proportions, I mean, than that. And they're increasing their overall tax rate by 10 percentage points would generate $3,000 billion in revenue over the next 10 years. And still leave the 1% with an average post-tax annual income of more than $1.4 million each. These are very general terms. And this is a very mild article. You can find it in The Guardian. And as I always say when I mention The Guardian, this is not a newspaper that necessarily is on your side, although they do have some good reporting in there. Don't expect them to make sense when it comes to imperial policy. You are listening to Press Watch, and it's almost 20 minutes after 9 a.m. Pacific time here in Portland, Oregon. So returning to the article on Chile, I was saying the Chileans have risen up because they're tired of being crushed by this system, and you are being crushed by the system. And so I would suggest to you that there is a reason why you don't get much news about what is actually happening in Chile. Returning to the article, a single example, while the executive there in Chile has announced a slow and gradual increase of salaries up to about $400 a month, the trade union movement has stressed that the minimum required for most families to be lifted out of poverty and indebtedness is $650 a month. Many analysts believe that these insufficient measures will only seek to calm the environment and gain time in hope that the social movement will lose strength after so many days of mobilization. And speaking for myself again, that's how they do it here as well. Some tiny reform to shut you up is not enough. And I'd like to ask, what is more moral? Is it more moral to absolutely have a general strike and shut down the society with all of the, it will cause deaths to do so. Some people will die because of a general strike, not intentionally. But simply because there's millions of people and all ends cannot be foreseen. For example, when power is cut off, people certainly die if they're dependent on the power for their breathing equipment, etc. But is it more moral to have the disruption and the stress and maybe the riots that it would take to shut down the system completely on May 1st, 2020? Or is it more moral to allow the system to go on and destroy the entire planet? Imagine 10 years from now, when you're fighting for breath, and the world is burning, and there are terrific droughts. Imagine Forest Park is on fire, and many people that you know and love have died. Can you imagine that it was more moral not to take every necessary step to fight for revolution and to end corporate climate disaster capitalism? What is more moral? And when will we mobilize? Returning to Chile, President Sebastian Piñera launched a security agenda aimed at strengthening the police apparatus and urgently processing bills against protesters rejected by broad sectors that accuse the executive of criminalizing peaceful demonstrators. Proof of police violence in these 2 months are frequent arbitrary detentions of thousands of people, including minors, more than 3,000 injured, including more than 350 with serious eye injuries, reports of torture, beatings, and even sexual assaults by security forces. International agencies, including the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, have denounced serious and repeated human rights violations and demanded that the government prevent such incidents, which has so far offered only evasive responses. We have human rights violations here in the United States, speaking for myself. It's called the grotesque overrepresentation of people of color in our prisons, and it's called the Jim Crow policing departments. But we don't call it human rights violations. It's called people living in a tent listening to me on a cheap battery radio right now. Hi, you deserve a house because you're a human being, at the very least, and probably because of all the good necessary work that you've done in your life and are probably still doing as many days of work as you can get, a week as you can get work. Where is the outrage? Where is the fire in our hearts to stand up for each other? That's what I want to know. Returning to the article about Chile. Meanwhile, the demand to draft a new constitution has been gaining space, for which the majority of the population demands a constituent assembly mechanism, while the government has reluctantly agreed to move forward in that direction, but under a different process. Right-wing parties of the ruling coalition do not conceal their efforts to save the current constitution imposed under Augusto Pinochet dictatorship and which underpins the repudiated neoliberal model. Now, let me give you a little history there, in case you don't already know. The United States, Henry Kissinger, enthusiastically supported Augusto Pinochet's dictatorship. That meant attacking the left, disappearing them, taking away their children, separating children from families in order to terrorize. Exactly the same thing that Trump is doing to people of color crossing the border. And throwing people out of helicopters. And the fascists who support President Trump love that so much that they have had t-shirts printed up and have seen them here in the streets of Portland, Oregon. Pinochet did nothing wrong, the t-shirts say, and they show a person being thrown out of a helicopter. The most terrorizing thing they could think to do. They took Victor Jara and broke his hands just for playing beautiful music against the dictatorship, against corporate capitalism. And they left his body where people could see it as they entered the prisons on their way to their doom. That's the sort of thing that American Nazis support. That's where the evangelistic white right is at. That's what they like. Pinochet did nothing wrong, they say. This, returning to the text, in the midst of an economic situation that was already showing signs of weakness due to external and internal factors, while President Sebastian Piñera and his executive failed to overcome record low approval ratings of barely 13%. 13%! And they're still in power. You call that a democracy? Because National Public Radio will. Just watch them. Listen to them, I mean. This from Radio Havana, Cuba. Dateline Buenos Aires during a press conference in Buenos Aires, Argentina. Bolivia's deposed president, Evo Morales, Tuesday analyzed the circumstances surrounding the coup d'etat against him and recalled some achievements of his presidency from January 22, 2006 till November 10, 2019. Quoting Evo Morales, "Unfortunately, neither the police intelligence nor army intelligence warned us that a coup d'etat was approaching." End quote. The movement towards socialism leader noted that the coup was a reactive response from the fascist and racist sectors to the structural changes that he was leading in Bolivia. And departing from the text, of course, we now know, of course, that the CIA and the NSA and the DIA and the State Department were deeply involved. Quoting Morales, "Our sin, our crime is to be an indigenous person and to have begun change with the participation of the Bolivian people." End quote. Bolivia's constitutionally elected president also defended his mandate's achievements, which are not based on the policies usually recommended by the IMF. And he's calling it the lithium coup. And indeed it was. You've been listening to Press Watch. I want to say again, a merry impeachmas to you. And again, I don't know exactly what I'm going to do about it, but if you search for my show on the web, you might find something confusing. Obviously, well-promoted little pictures appear saying "Press Watch," and that is not me. Look to see that it says KBOO, and I'm very angry about that because I put my life into Press Watch, and because the name Press Watch belongs to you. It belongs to the KBOO audience, and it belongs to me. In what proportion, I don't know, but I've put my life into it, and I'm not going to let them have the name Press Watch. I'd be interested to know what you have to say about it. You can find me, Teresa Mitchell, on Facebook, at KBOO Press Watch on Twitter. And as I was saying, this podcast is on Stitcher.com, KBOO.FM/PressWatch, and on Apple Podcasts, etc. You've been listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM on our great big red and white Eiffel Tower on the West Hills, and on other frequencies in Cascadia. You've also been listening on KBOO.FM, where we go out to you and to all the ships at sea.
Coming up next on KBOO, it's Fight the Empire with Per Fagerung, who discusses the House's passing of two articles of impeachment and looks forward to your calls.
They didn't decide how they can protect the animals or the environment or people more. Instead, they were like, well, how can we protect ourselves? And from that, they developed these protocols where prior to any large storm event, they're actually now locking all animals inside, boarding up the facilities, and bolt locking them with multiple different devices so that nobody can get in and nobody can get out.
You were just listening to Elizabeth Jones, also known as Ethically Elizabeth. She is an animal rights activist, a rescuer, marine biologist, and a conservationist. You can catch this episode of Voices for the Animals on December 27th at 10 a.m. right here on KBOO, or anytime after the 27th on kboo.fm/voicesfortheanimals, also on Google Play and iTunes.
Oh, I love that jaunty music. Well, this is Fight the Empire. My name is Per Fagerung, and it's, it's the end of 1 year, And another year looms ahead. And right now, the impeachment train is rolling on to some destination.